Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week, Anthony Martin of the New Esterhazy String Quartet joins me in studio, actually by phone, to talk about the quartet concerts that New Esterhazy is doing this weekend, with the theme The Danube Runs Through It. Also on the string front, about an hour or so ago, I spoke with violinist Augustine Hadalick at his hotel. He made his solo debut last night with the San Francisco Symphony, and you'll be hearing that recording hot from the field shortly. And Sheetal Gandhi will be here this hour. She's an intercultural, multidisciplinary director, choreographer, and performer whose solo work is at ODC this weekend. Stay tuned. Start this week's show with Anthony Martin. Anthony is a violist of the New Esterhazy Quartet. He joins me by phone now for a talk about the quartet's upcoming performances this weekend. Anthony, a Santa Rosa native, is a violinist as well. He attended Stanford, Peabody, and Boston University before finding his way back west, where he plays with several ensembles in addition to the New Esterhazy Quartet. Anthony, welcome to KLW.
Thanks. Glad to be on.
Before we talk about your specific program this weekend, let's get the audience informed about the name of your quartet, which in a way drives us toward your program, the New Esterhazy Quartet. Give us some little music appreciation 101 on Esterhazy, if you would.
Well, there are two angles to this. Esterhazy continues to be a family of Hungarian nobility, at least until the nobility was abolished. But now still a family of some wealth and influence in Hungary since the 15th century, and in the Austro-Hungarian Empire in the 18th century, they were a powerful and rich folk who employed Joseph Haydn for three decades. And their estate kind of started off like a hunting lodge, like Versailles was for the French kings at Esterhaz. And it became a magnificent set of buildings with two opera theaters, one for marionette operas, the other for live-action operas. Haydn was musically in charge of the whole establishment. So that's Esterhazy.
So we have a lot to thank the Esterhazys for in terms of a tremendous musical legacy that they sponsored.
Certainly. And then that connects up with the Esterhazy Quartet of the 70s, founded by Jaap Schroeder, Dutch violinist playing on period instruments. It was the first quartet in modern times to try to recreate the performing experience that Haydn, Mozart, and Beethoven had expected. Got strings, slightly different construction to the fiddles, perhaps a lower pitch, and so on and so forth, that which we now call period performance practice. The Esterhazy Quartet made some very beautiful recordings, gave a lot of influential concerts, and Jaap Schroeder was kind enough to allow us to honor his quartet's name by taking the name New Esterhazy Quartet.
And the New Esterhazy then has been in formation for how long?
7 years or so. Well, actually more than that, if you count the year that we spent reading all the Haydn quartets and discussing the project of playing them all in concert. We prepared that project rather carefully, and then in 18 concerts gave the first Haydn cycle on period instruments in America.
The rest of the quartet is Katie Keim on violin, Lisa Weiss on violin, and William Skeen on cello. These concerts are Saturday at St. Mark's Lutheran here in San Francisco, and Sunday in the evening at All Saints Episcopal Church in Palo Alto. Now, the program has a theme, A River Runs Through It, but is more accurately called The Danube Runs Through It, in which you're finding some interesting parallels between Franz Josef Haydn and Béla Bartók.
Well, there's the river, of course, is time as well as space. the Austro-Hungarian Union was rather like Yugoslavia in our own time, an uneasy mixture of cultures and languages and political infighting. However, we have it to thank that Austria was influenced by Hungary and Hungary influenced by Austria in the musical world. So we kind of look at that. Haydn, who all he had to do was go down to the local pub to hear gypsy musicians perform, and he incorporated often a gypsy or wild Eastern element into his music, especially in the quartets. And Bartok, of course, got beyond the gypsies, who were professional entertainers, to discover the actual peasant music, the music of real farmers in the Hungarian countryside in his ethnographic research.
You're approaching the Bartok works in a different way. Now, most Bartok performances are done on modern instruments. You're more you're leaning towards performing them on instruments that have gut strings.
Well, we're not just leaning. We're going in with both feet doing that.
And to the Danube with both feet.
Yes, we expect to come out soaked. But this is not this is not an attempt to prove a particular historical point. I mean, yes, it's very likely that the first performances of Bartok's first quartet were on gut strings, but that's just what everybody used before the First World War. At least artists did. It may well be that somebody who made his living playing outdoors used metal strings. The Capelli Waldbauer Quartet, who gave the first performance of Bartok's first quartet, certainly used gut strings before the big changeover that began with the First World War.
And how have you noticed a difference yourself when you hear the quartet perform on gut strings versus the modern strings?
Yeah, that is a subtle business. It's not merely what we hear, but it's also how it feels, how the strings respond to the bow, how the strings respond to our wishes. After all, at this point, except for the overspun lower gut strings, everything that we play on and with has been alive at one point, either vegetable matter of the trees or animal matter of the horses and the sheep. And somehow I don't want to say it softens the approach, because certainly we don't want to be soft in playing Bartok, but it removes some of the bright, shall I say, metallic brightness that we associate sometimes with, quote, modern music, although the Bartok Quartet is over a century old.
The program The Danube Runs Through It is Joseph Haydn's Quartet Opus 33, number 1 in B minor from 1781, and then Béla Bartók's Quartet number 1, Opus 7, which we're going to hear shortly performed by the Emerson String Quartet, or at least an excerpt thereof. And also a less familiar composer is on the program. Could you tell us a little bit about Imre Zelkeli? Did I say that correctly?
Well, you know, I'm not an expert in Hungarian pronunciation. I did ask about Esterházy if we left off the diacritical over the A, and a Hungarian was outraged. He said it would be, well, that would make it Esterházy. So, but I don't know. I imagine it's something like Shekai, as in the first violinist of the distinguished Hungarian quartet, Zoltán Shekai, with whom Lisa Weiss has studied this music.
Well, we should also be saying Béla Bartók, right? I suppose.
Or even Bartók keep those Béla.
Right, yeah, true enough.
They transposed first and last names. Well, in any case, Imre Shekai, I can tell you a little bit about him because that's all I know. There is a dissertation on his piano music written by an American, and I consulted with her, and she said that his reputation was as a composer of light music. Now, when we were looking for a quartet to thread between the two beads of Haydn and Bartok on this string or on the river, we got a great deal of help from the Hungarian National Library, and they turned us on to Shekai string quartets. Well, one of them in particular, the Quatuor Hongrois, the Hungarian quartet caught our attention and our interest when we read through his string quartets provided generously by the Hungarian National Library. It has five movements, and it has, shall we say, a strong Hungarian accent, and yet the music is neither Austrian nor Hungarian folk. It is somewhere in between. It seems like it is light, L-I-G-H-T music, or L-I-T-E music, perhaps, from the mid-19th century, what you might hear in a high-class hotel's lobby or dining room. That seems to denigrate the music. It's extremely interesting and very charming, and at times extremely sentimental, and other times takes itself a little bit seriously, but never in the way that we expect from the Viennese quartet tradition.
Are there other composers you're going to be exploring in a similar way with the new Esterházy?
You mean next season, perhaps? Well, yes. If Bartók weren't enough, we're going to play Schoenberg's first quartet, which is not number one. It's previous to number one. It was, I guess, number zero from 1897, even before he wrote Verklärte Nacht. The first and last movements are simply, they sound like Dvorak. The inner two movements sound very much like Brahms. So it will not be nearly as modern as the name Schoenberg suggests.
And any commissions on the horizon?
Well, we expect to be playing next season a work by the New York composer Paul Brantley, who came to our attention because he is writing a string quartet called Esterházy for the Flux Quartet, a new music special group in New York City. And when I inquired as to whether that piece might be playable on period instruments, since Paul Brantley has actually written music for period instruments, he replied no, he didn't think so, but since he knew us and our work, which was a surprise to us, he would like to write us a companion piece. So there will be Esterházy for the Flux Quartet and new Esterházy for us. The piece is not yet written. We don't have a performance scheduled, but we're committed to learn it and perform it next season at some point.
Very nice, Anthony. Well, I thank you for taking just a little bit of time for telling us about these upcoming performances.
My pleasure, and I'm glad that we came to your attention.
That's Anthony Martin. He's violist with the new Esterházy Quartet, which is composed of Katie Kime and Lisa Weiss on violins, along with William Skeen, cello. The program is The Danube Runs Through It. It's this weekend, Saturday the 20th at 4 p.m. at St. Mark's Lutheran Church here in San Francisco, and then Sunday evening at All Saints Episcopal Church in Palo Alto, an evening concert at All Saints Episcopal Church. Tickets at newesterhazy.org. Still to come, dancer Chital Gandhi and details about her program at ODC, and I'll have a visit with violinist Augustine Hadalek. But let's hear some music of Bartók now. Here is an excerpt from the Quartet No. 1, Opus 7, part of the new Esterházy's performances that you'll hear this weekend. Thank you. brief excerpt from the first string quartet of Béla Bartók, Opus 7, written in 1909. It'll be performed on period instruments by the New Esterházy Quartet this weekend. Information about those concerts at newesterhazy.org. Good afternoon once again. I'm David Latulippe, and you're listening to Open Air. I'll be talking shortly with Augustine Hadalick, who has his debut with the San Francisco Symphony last night and over these next several days. But next, I'm welcoming to the studios Chital Gandhi. Chital is doing her solo show at the ODC. The ODC Theater opens its 2013 season with the Bay Area premiere of Gandhi's magnetically rhythmic Bahu Beti Biwi. Sounds very rhythmic itself. It's a solo program that combines dance, vocalization, and a percussive text. And it kind of combines North Indian music traditions and family characters into a contemporary exploration that glides between humorous portraiture and active resistance. I'm sure Chital can tell me.
It's like lethal. Yeah,
lethal.
I mean, I'm a nice person, but it does rhyme.
Well, in any case, you can be much more eloquent about the program than I can. Welcome to KLW.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Your career has taken you from the Cirque du Soleil to a leading role in a Broadway production for Bombay Dreams. Now, tell us about this particular performance you're doing at ODC, which is very different.
Right. Yeah. Well, I do a lot of different things. And as an artist, it always made me feel split. So, you know, if I wanted to sing, I would work with a band. If I wanted to act, I would do a play. If I wanted to dance, I would, you know, work in concert dance. And someone once said to me, you know, I wonder if you just put yourself in a room with, you know, all of those skill sets and all the stories that you have, and you just, you know, put it together, you know, what would happen, you know, if you weren't bouncing yourself off of, you know, working with others and you just worked by yourself. And, you know, the thought actually scared me, but it was something I always wanted to do. So just a few years ago, I was in grad school at UCLA, and I took the time to begin to piece this together. And I didn't know I was going to make a one-woman show. It just started to evolve into that.
And informed by quite a few influences, then.
Yeah, definitely. Very multidisciplinary. So it's a platform where I get to bring all those different skill sets into one place. But also the seeds of this piece were planted many, many years ago when I was 17 years old, probably, and visited India. I'd been to India many times before that, but as I got older, I could see things with new eyes. And I started to be privy to some of the real feelings that the women in my family had about being newly married, about being a woman in that culture. And it really touched me very deeply.
Let's hear a little bit of an excerpt from the work, and then we'll talk more about what we heard and more about the work itself.
Rolling rotis with my auntie, perfect round over the heat. Cook them now, family eat. Not a life, not any life, but one specific auntie rolling 100 rotis. The perfect life, ha, take it the ha. My auntie is the perfect wife, ha, take it the ha. Tells me that her day is rife with ha, take it the ha. Donna, take it the. Trying to communicate, broken English over the heat. Glue the pieces, family eat. Take it the. Not a hand, not any hand, but mine. She takes my hand and says to me, I'm just like you, ha. Na na, take it the na. Donna Teki, she took my hand, take it the, said to me, I am what you call young blood. She's dreaming of all the same things that I'll get for free, ha. I'm like her, she's like me, na. But young blood, I know what she means, ha. Take it the na, ha. Take it the ma, huh? Ma, take it the ma, what? Ma.
That's an excerpt from Chital Gandhi's work, Bahu Beti Biwi. She joins me in the studio now. Boy, that's a fascinating combination of things going on there. Now, we can't really hold the microphone up to the video to see what's going on
right.
But tell us what we're seeing as we're hearing this. You have a percussionist involved as well. Is that correct?
Well, the music's all pre-recorded, but we did work with live music. And the composer's Joseph Trapanese, and he was amazing to work with. It was actually our first time working together, and he's doing a lot in Hollywood now with working on, you know, TV shows and scoring for films. But this was a great project where, like, in that specific section, I'm drawing on North Indian classical rhythms. And there's something called Badanth, where you speak the rhythms, and the bowls or the syllables, it's a drum and dance language. That particular phrasing is a chakradhar, and when I heard it, it just had this kind of driving intensity to it. And I knew I had this story to tell, and I thought, well, what if I replaced this drum and dance language, you know, the bowls, and what if I replaced it with English so that I can kind of push the narrative along, but in a different way rather than just doing a straight up monologue. So when I'm doing that, if you were to see it, my feet are moving pretty quickly. So you can hear that slapping on the floor. And then on top of that, I'm doing these rhythms vocally, and then there's gestures. So it's a very polyrhythmic sort of visual audio kind of experience.
Sure, it's an amazing combination of those, hearing those words as you would interpret it as you hear it from a percussive standpoint.
Yeah.
Well, let's back up a little bit to before this piece and your work with Cirque du Soleil. Tell us about. I understand it was an exhausting period for you.
Who told you that? Yes, we did 10 shows a week. I created a role called Ocean, Goddess of Water, and so I used elements of Indian classical dance, a little bit of Kathak, a little bit of Odissi, and my own contemporary dance language to create this character that weaves through the entire piece, sort of a main character that would bring on, you know, all the acrobats that were of the element water. And even though I had a very prominent role, it's also not my story. I'm there to provide the distraction, you know, when there's something technical going on, when the acrobats need to, you know, have some transition that's not very elegant. That's when I would, you know, kind of take center stage and distract. But it was great in terms of the exposure as well. I mean, doing 10 shows a week for 2 years, I would perform for 5,000 people per day. So it taught me how to have endurance. I mean, and also how to find the joy in what I'm doing every time, because otherwise you can't do it.
Sure, and as I've mentioned to another guest that does the same kind of a multiple times, the person that you're performing to in that audience of 2,000 is the first time
exactly. They're
seeing it.
I
so
was just
you just
got
to have that
right. Same
energy level, the 20th time, the 50th time, the 200th time you've done it.
Exactly. And that actually boosts my spirit to know that these people are seeing it for the first time. It's really special.
Mm-hmm. So let's take you back even further to some of your earlier training. Tell us a little bit about the influence that Donald McHale had on you, and whether, for the audience members that don't know the name, a little bit about his teaching style and his background.
Donald McHale, I just loved him to pieces. He danced in Martha Graham's dance company. I mean, he is just a very well-renowned, choreographer of black dance. He continues to set pieces on different companies around the country. He's a storyteller in his approach to dance, and I think that really resonated with me. And he also integrates different forms into his dance language, and that resonated for me. And he took a real interest in me, and so I would work with him in a lot of his pieces at UC Irvine. That's where I was introduced to him. And I would say he's my first mentor and one of my greatest mentors. He loved also working with rhythm, not in the same way that I'm doing it, but he's a humanist as a choreographer, and I've heard myself described in the same way.
Very nice. Now, growing up in Walnut Creek, I want to discuss your Indian heritage a little bit. Now, was that something that you were always around? Was it something you had to seek out, or is it something you're coming back to?
It was always there. I grew up in a very open-minded family, religiously not conservative at all, in fact, not religious at all, but very cultural and very appreciative of cultural traditions. So I grew up celebrating, you know, Diwali, but also Christmas and Easter and, you know, different Indian holidays. I have a great community of Indian family friends that I grew up with, because back in the 60s, when my parents moved here, there weren't so many Indian South Asian people. So if you saw somebody in your neighborhood, you'd invite them over for dinner. And so from that, we grew into this really wonderful community, celebrating, you know, holidays together, dinner parties, you know, almost every week. Very social bunch. We have great parties. This is my extended family. And so I would say I'm not coming back to the culture, but those two, my work as an artist and my upbringing felt very separate. And I never wanted to be identified as only because I'm South Asian, all the work I make is South Asian. So, in fact, for most of my career, I wasn't doing work that was specific about that, but I find that the world does want to put me in that category. And some of the biggest roles I've had on Broadway, in Cirque du Soleil, utilized that element of me. And I think that's just how I work with my Indianness in my life as well, is that I find the best parts of it and I roll it into me to give me just more breath.
And giving birth to a solo work here at ODC, which opens the 2013 season. It's tomorrow, the 20th and 21st. Let's hear another little excerpt and then we'll talk some more.
Fine, with my new pestle. I will grind red chilies fine with my new pestle and throw them in my father-in-law's eyes. I will grind red chilies fine with my new pestle and throw them in my father-in-law's eyes to blind him. I will grind red chilies fine with my new pestle and throw them in my father-in-law's eyes to blind him. My father-in-law's eyes. Then I won't have to cover. I won't have to cover. Grind, throw red chilies fine. Then I won't have to blind my father-in-law's eyes. Grind red chilies fine with my new pestle. Throw them in my father-in-law's eyes to blind him. My grandfather's eyes. Then I won't have to cover. I won't have to cover my face, my uncle's eyes. Then I will grind red chilies fine with my new pestle. Throw them in my father-in-law's eyes to blind him. Then I won't have to cover. I won't have to cover my face, my uncle's eyes. Then I will grind red chilies fine.
Sheetal Gandhi from her one-woman show at the ODC Theater, Bahu Betty Biwi.
You say that perfectly.
Right? Good, I'm glad
daughter-in-law,
I got that
daughter,
right.
Wife. That's great.
All right. her quite vivid life informing this wonderful work at ODC Theater. Now, we're in for a treat here because we're going to hear Sheetal perform live here in KALW. What are you going to do for us here?
This is a scene that comes up right after the one man that I play. So I play several characters, but only one of them is a man. And he's in a town called Jaisalmer in North India. And he's in a little chat room and he's, typing an email out to somebody, an Indian American woman back in America, who was probably visiting India, and they met, and he's typing to her, and his name is Ishak, but his sort of nickname is Ishu. And so what we see now, or what we hear, is this Indian American responding back to him.
A live performance here at KALW. Hit it.
My dear Ishu, things are fine here. I recently broke up with my boyfriend. It's okay, it wasn't meant to be. He loved his cat more than he loved me. I should have known there were signs everywhere. There were photos of his cat all over the walls and by his bedside table most of all. I thought I gave it a chance. I really hung in there. I thought I gave it a chance. I really hung in there. I even let it pass when he said that kids are a pain in the...
I'm going to stop right there.
Wise girl to do that. Thank you very much. There's the ballad of Sheetal and the cat. Is that the idea?
Yes.
Beautifully sung.
Thank you.
Sheetal Gandhi's one-woman show opening the ODC Theater 2013 season opens tomorrow, the 19th of April at 8 o'clock, also Saturday at 8 and Sunday at 7 p.m. The ODC Theater, beautiful space, 3153 17th Street. For tickets and information, odctheater.org. Sheetal, thanks so much
Thank
for being
you.
Here with me. And next to talk with Augustine Hadalick, who had his debut with the San Francisco Symphony. I caught the concert last night, and just this morning I talked with him in his hotel room. So it is a field recording now with Mr. Hadalick. Very pleased to hear your performance last night of the Beethoven Concerto. Congratulations.
Thank you.
One down, a feel for the hall, a feel for the symphony that you're working with, a fantastic audience reaction. Now, does that make the remaining performances that much easier?
It's always great to have more than one. You know, sometimes some places I go, there's only a single performance. And it's great. We have four performances. And what happens is that after the first one is over, the first one where there's, you know, a little bit of nervousness that everybody's feeling, you know, including the orchestra, that goes away, and then we relax and then we just enjoy it, the other performances. And there are always things that are a bit different in each one, but there's sort of this feeling, let's just enjoy this great piece of music rather than thinking, oh, we have to get everything perfectly right. You know, we've sort of gone through all that yesterday, and now we just relax and play.
You're doing the Beethoven with Herbert Blumstedt, San Francisco Symphony's conductor laureate, whom you've met before. Blumstedt, now an extraordinarily spry 86-year-old. Now, what insight is he bringing to your interpretation of the Beethoven?
Well, this is a piece that is very symphonic, you know, and the orchestra... the orchestra part of it is really a major part. The solo violin line isn't just leading everything and the orchestra is accompanying. It's often the other way around. There are many places where I'm supposed to follow the orchestra. So in an ideal situation, like this, I've been really happy with this week, because he's such an incredible musician, and the way that he conducts, for example, the orchestral introduction, the first movement, and the way he conducts this piece is really, you know, that's what I've always wished for. So it's really perfect, and it's very inspiring to me. And I've played this piece many, many times, and I've played it with good orchestras and with bad orchestras, and with every conductor it's different, but I've rarely had had such a great feeling as this week.
So you're counting San Francisco in the good orchestra category.
Yes, it's absolutely fantastic. And it was wonderful to hear the orchestra part played so beautifully and so just so perfectly. And then with such such incredible musical intention that Blomstedt brings to it, with this sense of phrasing and character and also joy, you know. Occasionally when I've done it, the piece, it can sound, the first movement, it can sound so serene that it's actually, it just puts everybody to sleep, but he brings a joy to it, you know. And sometimes he starts smiling and he just really he really loves this music. And
well, that's got to be a challenge for some of these concertos that have these long extended introductions. You're just standing there in front of the audience, they're anticipating your solo, yet you've got to react somewhat to what you're hearing behind you.
Yes, I think, you know, the what's great, I just listen to the introduction and I try to get sort of lost in the music and go with it, and you know, it helps me get immersed in the piece. So by the time I come in, it doesn't feel like, you know, this is my beginning, but I'm really continuing what the orchestra did. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly much easier if I really like how the introduction is being done, and if it's being done so beautifully, and just he started the piece so perfectly, that then it's it's much, much easier to come in and continue that and build on that.
It's also your debut with the San Francisco Symphony, and I understand not quite originally planned as part of the season originally. When did you find out you'd be including San Francisco on your tour?
You know, I think it was at some point in the fall. It might have been October, maybe. I'm not quite sure, but I remember getting a call from my manager, and who was very excited, and I was too, because I didn't expect it. Normally, engagements like this are, of course, planned much further in advance.
Sure.
Like two years in advance. So it's a wonderful surprise.
But this has happened before in your career as well.
Yeah, but the constellations that I had played before were often even more last minute.
Yeah.
And when I did my debut with the New York Philharmonic and also the one with the LA Philharmonic, those were both about 3 days before that I
How exactly does that work? I mean, do you get a reputation as the go-to guy for a last-minute substitution, or do your manager keep their ears open for these signings? Or?
Well, a few years ago when I did those debuts, I was not as busy every week as I am now. So I was just more likely to actually have time than I am now. But I think that when something like that happened last minute, you know, there is a bit of a, well, you have to find someone, you know, and that's when you get the chance, when maybe you wouldn't normally maybe be at the top of their list, and they give you that chance, and then you can prove yourself. And but it's also important to know when to say no if you don't feel ready. So another time I was asked, and it was just one day before, and it was a piece that I knew, but
not quite, you know, comfortable enough to be
with one day, and you have to travel during that day, of course.
Sure. Yeah.
So basically you have no time to practice, and so then it's better to just say no, and not make yourself completely crazy and then risk, you know, giving a good performance that I'm not happy with.
Sure. Yeah. Well, another way of proving yourself is through competitions, which are par for the course for any soloist. Now, they've been for some time. Naturally, they come with some important perks, part of which is financial, which allows you the luxury to play your music rather than serving half-decaf soy lattes at the local coffee shop. But one of the perks associated with winning of the Indianapolis competition is use of a very special instrument. Now, first of all, I had no idea that the Indianapolis was such an important competition, international competition, and it certainly was for you. I wonder if you could take us back to that 2006 competition.
Yeah, that was a big breakthrough moment for me, winning the Indianapolis competition. At the time, I was a student at Juilliard, and I was playing some concerts, but my name wasn't really known in the music circuit, music business, and it gave me a chance to play in front of a large audience, because it was one of the first Berlin competitions to be streamed online, and a lot of people tuned in, and then after that. I mean, of course, it was an incredible, stressful time. I have to say, competitions are the worst experience you could go through. But of course, it ended up being a good experience for me because I won it. But it still, I was happy that I didn't have to do that again, because normally when you perform, you're playing music with people, but in a competition, you play against other musicians and not with them. And I think it's that's what makes it so unpleasant. But it came with a lot of... it opened a lot of doors. I started to play a lot of concerts initially with a lot of small regional orchestras, and I got to gain this experience of playing pieces like the Beethoven just many times with different groups. And
I mentioned that the Indianapolis came with a perk of a special instrument. Mm-hmm. How is that always the case with the Indianapolis? And what was that?
Yes, they have the ex-Gingold Stradivarius, and of course Joseph Gingold founded the Indianapolis competition and was this important teacher at Indiana, and his violin is a beautiful violin from an early phase of Stradivarius' work, and I got to play it for 4 years, and it was very beautiful. And then what I play on now for about 2.5 years is another Stradivarius, which was built 40 years after, which I got about 2.5 years ago, which is wonderful as well. I think that for soloistical purposes of playing a big hall with orchestra, this one is better suited because it projects a bit more clearly. And
I always found that interesting, that the instruments that Beethoven was so frustrated with when he was working on his piano concerti were the pianos of the day. Whereas really the stringed instruments are of the same vintage, with the exception of the string composition, because of the size of the halls, really the same instruments that Beethoven was writing for and intended to be performed on.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about that the violin as an instrument, it hasn't really been improved upon since, the 1700s.
But of course, the string composition went from gut to
yes, and the setup and the necks have all been replaced, and there are certain things about the setups that are different. And yes, we use synthetic strings now, which just have much more power. So they are set up a bit different. They didn't sound this powerful back then, but overall, violin makers now, they try to make instruments as close to that as possible, which is amazing if you consider that the piano, yes, is there's no absolutely no comparison between pianos now and then.
You mentioned elsewhere that when you're on tour, it's usually with a specific single concerto, not like a whole folder of music. Is that just to keep your head in the one piece that you'll be doing over several days?
What do you mean?
You're not going from Beethoven this week to Tchaikovsky next week.
Oh, I do actually.
Oh, you do? Okay.
I do play a lot of repertoire during the season. I think this season it's 12 concertos. So last week I did Paganini No. 1, and the week before I did Brahms, and I have Mozart 5 coming up, and then Thomas Ades concerto. So it's a lot of. It's a lot of repertoire, all of which I've played before. What I love about it is that I'm always very, very excited about each piece that I play, and I'm never bored at all. I'm just this week, playing the Beethoven again. It's really exciting. It's not this feeling of I've been doing this for 4 weeks, that being said, that makes it particularly important that during the week that I play this piece, I not think about anything
that's what
else.
I think
it would be dangerous if I suddenly started to practice Thomas Ades this week, because then when I step on stage and suddenly I'm playing Beethoven, you know, the feeling of style might not be quite right, or I'm just not gonna, you know, be in that right mindset. So
the program here in San Francisco also includes Nielsen's Fifth Symphony. Is the Nielsen Violin Concerto in your bag of tricks as well?
I have not yet played the Nielsen Violin Concerto.
You make your home in New York City now, a long way from your native Tuscany, where your German parents immigrated before you were born. Both of your parents very musical and fostering your musical inspiration early on. Now, what do you miss about Italy, if anything?
I get very homesick nowadays, actually, for Italy. In the first few years that I was gone, I didn't think about it so much. I'd been living in the countryside there in Italy, and that sort of took all that nature and beauty for granted. And I wanted to move to a big city, so I went to New York, and I loved it. But now that I've been there for a few years, I start to get homesick for, you know, the vineyards and the olive trees and the blue sky and the sea and, you know, just...
And family, of course, still there.
And the family, of course. And so I go back about twice a year. And okay.
Having an international solo career gets you to cities and regions all around the world now. Have you thought about where you'd like to eventually settle down?
You mean where I want to live?
Yeah,
where,
yeah.
You know, I'm very happy in New York, actually. I went to Juilliard for 3 years, and I finished in 2007, and then I stayed because most of my concerts were in the U.S., and it seemed like a good base. But I've really fallen in love with the city, and I think I'll stay there. I mean, you never know what might happen. I know a lot of people who were these diehard New Yorkers, you know, who said, I'll never move away. And then suddenly they're gone and they moved somewhere else. So, you know,
sure.
Maybe that'll happen.
I'm among them. So I understand you've passed through San Francisco before, but this is the first time you've spent some time here in San Francisco. Now, when did you arrive? And do you have some downtime while you're here?
You know, not too much downtime. I got here on Monday, and... You know, rehearsal started on Tuesday, and then, of course, we have four performances. So there is not too much time to sightsee, I'm afraid, because I leave after the last performance. And that's actually often what happens, is that I travel to a place and I don't see too much of it. But, yeah, I don't know.
Well, we're going to conclude with a cut from your new CD called Histoire du Tango, taking its title from Astor Piazzolla's work of the same name, originally for flute and guitar, by the way. As a flutist, I need to point that out. Uh-huh. Now, the title, L'Histoire du Tango, takes its title from four movements, four specific historical tango styles. But on that CD, there's also music of Defia, Paganini, and Sarasate on that new CD. How do they all fit in to this CD?
Oh.
Histoire du Tango. Tango.
Yes. Well, the Piazzolla is the centerpiece of the program. That's what we started out with, and it was the first piece that Pablo and I played together. And I know that, yes, we violinists, we always steal the flute repertoire as well.
I should mention that the CD is with the guitarist Pablo Sanz Villegas.
Yes, Villegas.
Villegas.
Pablo Sanz Villegas. He is he's an amazing guitarist. And so we met in 2009, and we started reading together. And so we played this Piazzolla, and then we started exploring the other repertoire, because we wanted to play some concerts, and I was so taken by the combination of the sound of the violin and the sound of the guitar, which you rarely hear, but it's just very, very beautiful. I thought, you know, we have to do something. We have to record a CD. And Paganini is an obvious choice, because he wrote a lot of music for violin and guitar, but the quality is kind of uneven, so we went through a lot of different pieces, and eventually we settled on a piece called Sonata Concertata, which is actually maybe the only work that he wrote that gives the guitar a somewhat equal role. It's really a duo and not just the guitar just accompanying. And then we arranged the Moses Variations, which is a showpiece by Paganini. The Defia songs are pieces that I had played with piano before. You know, they're often done on the violin, but the piano part in the Defiant, it often imitates guitar sounds, because in Spanish folk music, the guitar is the accompanying instrument that accompanies the voice. And so I think it's actually very idiomatic to do it with guitar. And it's the same way with the Zigeunerweisen by Sarasate. Of course, it's generally done with piano accompaniment or orchestral accompaniment, but actually the textures and the sounds that are imitated, or that the accompaniment is trying to imitate, are guitar strumming sounds, because in the gypsy band, you have a guitar, you don't have a piano. And so there are many parts of it that suddenly sound much more gypsy, authentically gypsy than the original.
How did you prepare for the tango end of things?
Well, we, you know, of course, with Piazzolla, we immediately knew, well, this is, you know, he doesn't write everything in the music. It's a little bit like playing Baroque music, in that there's a certain amount that's on the page, but there's all the stuff that players of the time were assumed to know about ornamentation, about, you know, tempi. And it's a little bit the same with Piazzolla. He just assumed everyone around him knew how to play tango. So we enlisted the help of some tango specialists and a tango violinist in New York called Leonardo Suarez Paz, who knew Piazzolla and has a connection to Piazzolla's band, and who coached us with it. And I had also taken some tango lessons, so we really did our best to get the style right, because we didn't want to for it to be another recording of a that just sounds like a classical player playing tango music, but that's not really that doesn't really have that tango feeling to it. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I hope you spend some more time in San Francisco on your next visit. You have a chance to be seduced by this beautiful city. And I wish you every wonderful kudo for the next several performances while you're here in town. And thank you for taking a little time for talking with us today.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah.
Remaining performances of Augustin Hedelic with Herbert Blomstedt, conducting the San Francisco Symphony, are tonight up at UC Davis, and tomorrow and Saturday evening here in San Francisco at Davies Symphony Hall. Beethoven's Violin Concerto, along with Nielsen's Fifth Symphony, on tap. Information about those concerts at sfsymphony.org, and you can read a terrific article about Hedelic, penned by our own open-air producer, Neil Swinkles, at San Francisco Classical Voice online, sfcv.org. As I mentioned, here's a part of a track from Augustine's latest CD. It's with guitarist Pablo Sanz Villegas. Here is part of the Nightclub 1960 movement from Piazzolla's L'Histoire du Tango. Violinist Augustine Hadelic with Pablo Sanz Villegas on guitar from Augustine's latest CD, Histoire du Tango. Augustine, soloist with the San Francisco Symphony this weekend and tonight up at UC Davis. Information about those concerts, performing Beethoven, by the way, not Piazzolla, at sfsymphony.org. Well, there are a couple of other concerts that are coming up and events coming up that I wanted to let you folks know about. One is the San Francisco Literary Society presents Sex in the Abbey, upstairs and downstairs, next Wednesday, April 24th in Mill Valley. You'll hear excerpts from the series and an introductory talk by our very own Peter Robinson. Information 415-381-6671 for Sex in the Abbey, upstairs and downstairs. Alonzo King's Lines Ballet 30th Anniversary Spring Season boasts a dream collaboration between visionary choreographer Alonzo King and venerated double bassist and composer Edgar Meyer. Those performances happen with live performances by violinist Rob Moose, as well as Gabriel Cabezas, cellist, will happen tomorrow through the 28th. Information at the YBCA, Yerba Buena Center box office, ybca.org. And also join host Chloe Veltman tomorrow evening at 10 for an interesting show with composer Mason Bates on voice box. Mason Bates has written song cycles for Chanticleer. He's currently affiliated with the San Francisco Symphony. He'll talk about how composers tackle setting texts in different languages. Sarah Cahill is your host for Then and Now, 2 hours of new and classical music, Sunday evenings from 8 to 10. And then on Monday at 9 p.m., join me once again for Explorations in Music, where we explore the music of Franz Schubert with the Alexander String Quartet and Robert Greenberg. I'm David LaTulipe. You've been listening to Open Air.